Hi there, listener. It's Matthew. You've come looking for an episode of the Children's Book Podcast, and you've found it. Hooray! But you're probably wondering why the name of the podcast has changed. After 8 years of doing the Children's Book Podcast, I began a new career as head of podcasts at A Kids Company About, where I now oversee a podcast network dedicated to producing original content that talks up to kids, centers the things going on in their world, and engages and challenges how they see the world and themselves. All of the episodes of the Children's Book Podcast are still here, but now, if you're subscribed, you'll get new episodes of Worth Noting, a kids podcast about current events, hosted by me. Something for you and the young people in your life to enjoy together. Enjoy this episode, and I hope you'll check out Worth Noting and other podcasts from A Kids Company About. Hey, guess what? You're awesome. Thank you all for supporting the Let's Get Busy podcast. I am blessed beyond words, not only to get to talk to these great people every single week, these authors and illustrators, these award winners and up-and-comers, but also to get to share the podcast with you. And thank you all for sharing such kind words with me and support and helping to make this podcast possible. It's directly because of your love and support of this podcast that this is even a thing that I can do. So, thank you. Enjoy the show. Welcome to Let's Get Busy, a weekly podcast where I talk shop and get down to business with authors, illustrators, award winners, up-and-comers, and everyone in between. I'm Matthew Winner, an elementary school librarian, author of the Busy Librarian blog, and your host. This is episode number 169 with Jory John, author most recently of I Will Chomp You, which is illustrated by Bob Shea and published by Random House. Oh my word, I love Jory John. I know, you probably do too. And if you've met Jory, you know he's every bit as funny and surprising and as sincere as his books. Jory and I talk about a ton of different people he's recently worked with, many of whom you may have actually heard on this podcast. Mac Barnett, who he wrote The Terrible Two with, Benji Davis, who illustrated Goodnight Already, Bob Shea, who illustrates his brand new book, Jason Wells, who works at Abrams and helped organize this crazy tour that he and Mac went on, and Stephen Malk, who's that fabulous literary agent that is connected to so many wonderful people because he's such a great guy himself. I mean, it's a lot to take in, and it's a lot to enjoy. I hope you find humor and inspiration and a whole lot of heart and soul in this listen. Here's episode number 169 of the podcast with Jory John. Let's get busy. Welcome to the Let's Get Busy podcast, Jory John. At long last, you're here.
Hello, Matthew. Thank you so much for having me on, man. I dressed up for this. I know you can't see it, but I'm wearing a three-piece suit right now.
Oh, that's nice. I'm wearing my fancy pants.
Oh, you are. I've heard about those fancy pants.
You know. I happen to be wearing them. Those that talk. I am legit.
Oh. Well, I am just grateful for the company. I actually haven't talked since yesterday, so this is a real pleasure for me.
Yeah, welcome back from your flight from wherever.
Thank you so much.
Home safely.
Thank you.
Yeah. Jory, you come up a lot in my conversations with my library friends, and I mean that in such a sweet way. I feel like this podcast, actually, we were talking a little bit about it before recording, but this podcast ends up being something authentic. I aim for authentic conversations and connecting that way, and you and I got to connect prior to recording today. And that time that we met at TLA, is a story that I tell lots and lots and lots of people. That was a really cool chance to meet you and to run into Mac as well. And just, I don't know, there's something really special about seeing the people behind the books and just knowing, I don't know, knowing just what great people you are. I'm really thankful that, that you are who you are, Jory.
Oh, thanks so much. And, you know, I definitely remember that. And, I remember Mac and I were at the Abrams booth and we were doing our thing, which involves a lot of bantering. And, it involves, we have a prankster's oath for the book, The Terrible Two, and we'll swear people in. And so we were just surrounded by folks and swearing them in. And I remember you coming up and we got a chance to chat, which was great. And then, I remember later running into you again, and you happened to get an early copy of I Will Chomp You, which is the picture book I have coming out next month. And I think there are 5 in existence, so I'm really happy that you are one of the 5. And I think they're only printing 5, so it's going to be valuable.
Well, I'm excited that I have it then. And I have to say, I actually owe Mac Barnett thanks for that, because when I was over at the booth, there were a ton of people over at the booth, and having never been a person to go up to Random House of all people and just say, hey, can I have this copy of whatever off your shelf? I was with my friend Nancy Joe, and I found it as you sent me over there. Hey, I think they have copies over. So I went over and asked if I could have a copy. And one of the ladies said, well, yeah, you can have a review copy, but who do you write for? And Mac came up behind me and put his arm around me and said, I can vouch for this guy. He's a good guy.
Yeah, Mac. Mac always comes in and saves the day. The way we met was my car blew a tire and I was on the side of the highway. He just pulled over and he had a jack, lifted up the car, put the tire on and drove away. And I was like, who is that guy? Years later, we ended up collaborating. So
you're kidding.
I mean, I am kidding about half of that story. Yeah.
I'll take it. It's a good one. Keep the story.
All right.
Fantastic. Well, I love that you did collaborate on The Terrible Two, because it's hilarious, and it feels a lot like, having known you both now, it feels a lot like your personalities coming together to tell this story. It's wonderful. And I'm so excited. I saw in the catalog the other day that the sequel is, at least they're ready to ship out some arcs, I think, soon.
Yeah, we're very excited. So Mac and I go back, the true story is, we go back more than 10 years. We actually worked, we worked for Dave Eggers, essentially. He started a nonprofit called A26 Valencia, and he also started, a publishing house called McSweeney's. And Mac and I were starting as interns, and we met on our very first day, immediately hit it off, became friends. And, you know, then throughout the next 10 years, we stayed in touch wherever life would take us. Mac ended up moving to LA for a while. I was in San Francisco. Then Mac came back up to the Bay Area. And we started having these work days at his house where it would just be two sort of lonely writers who hadn't, like I said, hadn't spoken to anybody that day, meeting up to work at his house. And we would work independently on our own stuff. And then we'd go out to lunch and take a walk through the neighborhood and talk and then go back to his house and get back to work. And then, you know, on one of those lunch walks, we just started talking about pranking and pranks we never pulled, but we wanted to pull. And, Mac and I have a bit of an overlap in terms of our childhood, in terms of, we moved around a lot. We both essentially grew up in single mother, only child households. And so in The Terrible Two, you'll find some of that. So we just took a lot of the overlap, and then we took, you know, some of those pranks that we never pulled and put them in the book. And that was actually the genesis of how that came to be. And we started working on something together, during those work days.
So did you actually start The Terrible Two way back then? Like, has it been something on your minds for that long to actually write a middle grade novel for children, or just the idea of, I don't know, the idea of pranking itself?
Well, the idea of collaborating was on our minds. And, you know, our very first collaboration, as far as I remember, was a little piece for the McSweeney's humor site where we wrote about pocket dialing. And it was a smaller start to what became a bigger collaboration. and so, yeah, years ago, we wrote a piece together. And like I said, we've just been great friends since. And we'd go to trivia nights and we'd go over and watch the Oscars together. And there was always something that we were doing together. And so I think the idea of a collaboration was always on both of our minds. And we were just kind of waiting for the right idea to come about. And, for some reason, this really took off to the point where we got back from whatever lunch that was, opened both of our laptops, sat across the table from each other, opened a Google Doc, and started writing this book, which, you know, it's a very interesting process to learn to write a middle grade novel with somebody. And it was something that we had to figure out. In the very beginning, we were literally sitting across from each other. And in a Google Doc, you could see what the other person is typing. And there would be moments where, you know, one person would start a sentence and the other person would literally finish that sentence. I remember this moment that Mac and I talk about where one of the characters got up and sat in the front of the classroom. And then one of us did that, and the other person got that same character up and moved him to the back of the classroom. Actually, that might be vice versa, but in any case, you can see what I mean. Like, you have two people working on the same manuscript, and it's really interesting results. And I think in this case, both of our sort of our senses of humor created something bigger than what we might have accomplished individually on this kind of idea.
Yeah, I think that's such a great testament to collaboration. It's always that end product being greater than the two people working on it or the group of people working on it. Cool, though, to know that you were just kind of in the same room working, sometimes, you know, right across from each other on that same story and seeing ideas come together that fast like that, as opposed to, I don't know, you working on it and then him picking it up and editing it or going forward, or just one of you writing and the other shooting off ideas. That's the real deal. You are really sewn together that way.
And as time went on, you know, we experimented in all the different ways, and I still think we're in a way we're sort of figuring out what the most expedient process to create great results will be. And sometimes, like these days, sometimes we're in different rooms and working on different chapters. So it really is all over the place. I think the most fun for me personally, and I think Mac might agree to this, are those days where we're literally in the same room. Maybe one person is pacing around, the other person is typing. It kind of reminds me of what I hear about, like, you know, the comedy rooms at Colbert or something, where everyone's just throwing out ideas and some stick and some don't. And, you know, it really felt like that. It was a really nice sense of camaraderie when we were doing this. And, it felt like such a different thing than sitting in an office all day by yourself and, you know, not speaking.
I was thinking that same thing along the lines of Colbert. Have you seen that there was a documentary made about Saturday Night Live, about what it takes to get the show on the air, and just follows the production of Saturday Night Live? James Franco films the entire thing, but it goes through.
Oh yes, I haven't seen it. I want to see that. I have read the oral history live from New York.
Okay.
The Tom Shales book. Have you read that?
Yeah, I'm aware of it. I haven't read it, but I'm aware of that one too. Yeah.
Yeah.
What I like about that is the idea that too, when you tour together, if I'm picturing it the right way, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, you know, when you're working by yourself, it's hard perhaps to have a barometer on what is funny or what does sound good. But working with someone hand in hand, you even get almost not – sometimes you get cracking the other person up, and you get trying harder and maybe taking more chances in front of this other person, trying to see what will be funny. Hopefully. But also I loved seeing in that documentary, and probably you've experienced this now too, just not even cracking the other person up, but the other person saying – yeah, that's funny. Let's write that down. Like,
that's it. That we absolutely have experienced that. The whole like knowing look and the nod and then the very analytical, like, yes, that is funny and we will use it. And absolutely I feel like both, Mac and I are students of humor in that way you know, approach it from like not only what's funny, but, you know, what best serves these characters and what advances the plot. But, you know, I definitely agree with you that, you know, and also, you know, I hear these in every sort of walk of sort of comedy life, you have these folks that it's not necessarily about the laugh as much as just sort of acknowledging that it works and it'll fit. And, you know, yeah, we absolutely had that.
Yeah, I love in your story too that you've got, I mean, it, in a lot of ways, it, I don't know that it parallels your writing process. I don't mean to say it that didactically, but the way that you have Niles and Miles, these two kids that one came from being the best prankster in all of his school, and the other one is sort of a renowned, or maybe a not renowned, he's just is a very well versed prankster, and the idea of working together to create something bigger and and being willing to sort of hand over yourself to the other person and trust the other person. It causes me to think too that in this writing, perhaps you were both even pushing each other to write to your best self as well.
I think that's totally true. And also I should make clear that like, while we are talking a lot about comedy and jokes and what's the funniest thing, I really think that this is a story about friendship, and it does have a lot of heart, and it's about two kids who are lonely and who have, you know, in Miles' case, has moved to a new place and does, you know, is trying to figure out who he is all over again and has lost his identity to an extent. And I know that Mac and I both went through that too. You know, when you have Mac on your show, I'm sure he'll talk about this or dispute everything I'm saying right now. But I know personally, like, I moved up to Lake Tahoe at around the age that Miles is in the book. And, this was after a life in Santa Cruz, which is a coastal town in California. And so everything was very different for me. I definitely had to figure out who I was all over again. And, you know, it was a rough few years actually. And just trying to ease back in to sort of, having any sort of semblance of a social life and making new friends and figuring out the sports, you know, moving from a coastal town where, you know, the ocean was the thing, moving to Tahoe where mountains were the thing. And I remember a very specific ski week where they would take your whole school up and they would make you go down the hill and sort of assess how you are as a skier in front of your whole class.
Oh, geez.
I don't
no
know
pressure.
If you've ever had anything like that, but I definitely was called a beginner by the ski instructor and put into the bunny hill. And I think that was very formative for me and definitely determined my path for better or for worse.
I talked to Mac again. He comes back on, I don't know, in a month or something to talk about his new picture book, Leo. I'll have to bring it up again.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because,
you should.
Yeah.
We should have an ongoing series where I say stuff from Mac's point of view and he comes back on and says that it wasn't true at all.
Let's definitely do that. And then he can lobby back or pitch back to you. I wanted to say too, and I don't mean to jump on your words, but I wanted to say too that this is a book that really stuck with me, not only because I thought the story was so well crafted, and I really mean that. I thought it was seamless the way you two wrote together, but also I thought to take the topic of pranks, but really, really to show two characters that are not, maybe that they're not mean to each other, or rather Niles, I kept waiting for Niles to be a bad guy. Hmm. And he's just not. He just wants to befriend and form this alliance with Miles. He just sort of relentlessly wants to love this new kid and say sort of, I get you. I know where you're coming from. And it takes, you know, I feel like the main story that you have going on in Terrible 2 is more of that journey of Miles sort of accepting that he doesn't have to, his defining characteristic doesn't have to be really ultimately, I think we learned that he's this jerk, but rather that he can have it be a craft, an art, and have people appreciate him in a different way and also be connected, be part of a tribe.
Absolutely. I love hearing that too, what you got out of it. And you never know what folks are going to take from it, which is just such a fun thing now that people are reading it and have read it to hear this, response. And, you know, I will say that I really do think that we went into it, trying to craft these characters that sort of, complemented each other. So while Niles is so brilliant about planning ahead and has so many amazing ideas as you see throughout the book, we really wanted to make Miles somebody who's just incredible on his feet and can think of an idea like that and maybe is a little bit more impulsive and maybe some of it backfires, but he really complements Niles's sort of reticence and you know, that way when they I don't want to give any spoilers here, but when they eventually team up, they create sort of a power duo. And I think what you'll find in the second book when it opens is that it opens with them in a golden age of their pranking.
Oh, so we're going to go into the future a little bit.
I mean, yeah, like, I don't want to give too much away, but
well,
yeah.
Don't give too much. Well, maybe give a couple things that I can ask pointedly. What's the title of the sequel?
It's called The Terrible Two Get Worse.
Terrible Two Get Worse. And when is the publication date?
It's January 16th, I believe, of 2016.
Of 2016. So yeah. Almost exactly a year after the first came out, right? Didn't the first come out in mid-January?
Exactly.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, and you'll see more of an emphasis and a focus on Principal Barkin. And I wanted to point one thing out that we specifically tried to do in book one, which was Principal Barkin is the authority figure at Yonne Valley Science and Letters Academy, which is where the kids go to school. But we really wanted to create a principal who, while he is hot-headed and while he does play favorites and while he does fly off the handle, you know, we really tried to give him sort of we wanted to make him three-dimensional. We wanted to make him clearly a principal who cares about his job. He's very excited to go to school. You see a very early scene when he wakes up 1 minute before his alarm clock and he gets in the shower and he's singing about school and he has his favorite breakfast while he's reading the seven principles of principal power. And, you know, we just really wanted to create sort of an endearing authority figure that I actually really like him. And I
was going to say the same thing. I mean, I almost felt like it was not quite, but I almost felt like it was like a Principal Belding kind of character from Saved by the Bell. This idea that it's not that he's a bad guy. In fact, you almost feel bad for him in the end when you find out that his whole family lineage of principals of class presidents to principals end up putting – I mean, that puts a lot of pressure on him. And so it's that notion, again, kind of like what Miles and Niles go through in that way of what do we do when it feels like there's this assumed pressure on yourself to be a certain person.
Exactly.
I just feel like that's another dimension of the same theme. It's great.
And we've all gone through that. You know, we've all had to live up to certain familial expectations. And Principal Barkin wants to be a principal in one way. His dad, who's still – around and very active and calls him and screams at him over the phone, wants him to be a principal in another way. And, you know, there's a scene where they're eating dinner and his dad calls him and he hears about a mishap at school. And basically the whole chapter is written in all caps with his dad yelling at him over the phone. And, you know, you really get to see a little bit of behind the scenes where maybe you wouldn't in other books about principles, about, you know, who he is and where he's coming from.
Yeah, that was great. Well, despite not being able to share anything about The Terrible Two Get Worse, I'm excited that we'll have it in, you know, not too long here, in a couple months. The ARCs will start circulating, and that'll be – I'm glad that we've got another one coming out. Are you contracted to do more than two?
Yeah, we're actually signed up for four.
Great. Wow. Congratulations. That's great to have so many in advance like that.
Thanks very much. I mean, it's been a real whirlwind. Honestly, this is 6 months later after the first book has come out. And
yeah.
I think, at least personally, I'm still trying to wrap my mind around how sort of it's all gone. You know, we had this amazing tour.
I was like, Jory, you did a tour of who's the guy from Abrams that put the tour together? I can't ever remember his name.
His name is Jason Wells.
Jason, I wanted to say Jamie. Jason Wells was saying that it was like a 30-visit, something like that tour. It was craziness. What was it?
It was that. I think what you said. It was craziness. no, Jason is incredible at what he does. He decided we were gonna shoot for 22 cities. I mean, it was either gonna be 2 or 22, and 22 seemed grander. And so, you know, we started in Houston, Texas, and on the very first week of the tour, we did 22 school visits in a week, Monday through Friday.
There it is, 22 school visits in a week.
Yeah, ugh. I know. I came from more of a, you know, my previous books leading up to the last couple have been humor books, so I wasn't doing a lot of school visits, so this was a really interesting way of being thrown into the frying pan, and we definitely, you know, very quickly worked out a routine where Mac and I have this school visit, which I feel like you should come to sometime. It's really fun, and it's this circuitous sort of path to being a book reading where, you know, the essence of it is we start out in the beginning as healthy. Well, here's what happens. The principal will come out at each assembly and say, unfortunately, I read the book last night, and I just realized how much it's about pranking. And unfortunately, we don't have pranking here. We have to cancel this assembly, and all the kids will just boo. of course. But the principal will say, while you're here, though, and while we're already at an assembly, we found two local pediatricians, and they're here to talk to you about healthy eating choices. So, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the Rockin' Docs.
And then, Rockin' Docs.
Yeah, we come out in our lab coats, and we have fake mustaches. And for the first 5 to 10 minutes, it's the worst presentation you've ever seen. It's about how, you know, we talk about, we'll have a picture of an orange, and we'll ask the kids to put their thumbs up if they think it's a cool food, or put their hands out if they think it's a stop sign food, which is a term we invented, which we thought was particularly condescending.
Stop sign food.
And, you know, we just go with that for 10 minutes or so, to the point where, you know, I would say 90% of the kids believe that we're really doctors there to give a presentation.
No, they do. Yeah. Oh, children.
And even in the very beginning, when some of them will say, like, you know, those are the authors, we'll just sort of keep going with it long enough where they believe it. And then finally we rip our mustaches off and take our coats off and we say, we're the terrible two, and they go crazy. And that's the beginning of a 45-minute presentation about pranking, and we teach them how to be a prankster, and then it kind of circles around to a reading and then a Q&A and so forth. But, you know, that's what we're doing at every school. So we're really trying to make it a magical experience for every kid that gets to see it.
You know, I have to confess that as soon as you started on it, I knew what you were talking about because you visited John Shu's school and he shared some pictures.
Oh, yeah.
And I didn't put together the context of how the presentation went, but images were coming to mind as you were talking. I'll have to link to his blog post in the show notes. That is so much fun. You should, I don't know, think about if you go to a library conference, if you both are together at a library conference to do a session and just straight up do the session as what your author visit would be. I think that we don't often get to sit down and enjoy a visit for what you're doing. It's great to get to talk about your books and all that, but I think part of the talent that you have, or that you learn to have because you end up being in front of so many children when you write a book, is finding the way to talk to them and connect with them and engage them through your stories and through, you know, actually your story itself of coming to writing. That's something that would be really fun. You're right. I hope that one day I'll get to see you.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Mac, share that.
And I will say, Mac and I both came from backgrounds of working with kids for many years. You know, I actually started as an elementary education major before I switched to journalism, but then I ended up working at 86 Valencia, the educational nonprofit, for about 6 years as the programs director, and Mac was the executive director of 86 LA. And so, you know, in a big way, we were, you know, on the front lines of working with children for many years. And I really feel like we came away from that experience knowing how to talk to them. And, you know, if we didn't before, which I think we did. And then also just sort of knowing what they would like, what they would respond to. And so it was a great learning experience for us as well, I think.
You know, we keep hitting on all these different things that you're doing, and I love it. And it's so great to know, when I talk to Mac, to learn about the camp that he used to work at and that time with 826 LA, and now hearing it from you, there's something that you just can't fake in the way that you write for children, but more importantly, in the way that you tell a story, the way that you engage through your storytelling.
Oh, thanks.
That I think it comes from, I mean, it must come from you and your time in front of children, but more importantly, not just, you know, being with them, but also wanting to be with them and
totally
wanting to connect with them.
I absolutely agree that you can't fake it. And, you know, you can really tell, when you're sort of working with folks who are working with children, who sort of the folks that are naturals and, you know, that know how to talk to kids. And, it was always something that I was aware of in my capacity as the programs director there. Yeah, I definitely feel like we've tried to so much of this podcast is me speaking for Mac. I'll speak for myself. I've tried to take some of that, you know, and translate that into the writing.
Well, it works. This is all I gotta say too. I love that you are writing for children because I have had a copy of All My Friends Are Dead on my shelf, probably since it came out. It was just something that I was shelf reading somewhere, maybe Barnes & Noble or somewhere. I just had it out on display. I remember grabbing it and just, God, I read that book over and over and over so many times because it's hilarious. So having you come from talking to adults in that way too, or just sharing little ideas, sharing snippets, sharing, I don't know, humor, puns. I don't even know what to say. It just is so fun for me to know that that book exists in the dark, subversive kind of writing that it is, and that also you're writing for children, because I think they go hand in hand. I think that all makes sense in my head.
Yeah, I mean, you know, honestly, like, I think I love the example of somebody, this is absolutely not to compare myself to him, but I love the example of somebody like Shel Silverstein, who did just what you're saying, which you know, he would write things, I think, without necessarily considering the audience. He would just write what he thought worked or what he thought was particularly funny or poignant or whatever he was going for. And I feel like, you know, that's pretty important in writing, where you're not necessarily always thinking of the audience as much as you're just trying to figure out what works for you. And with All My Friends Are Dead, that I could tell you for certain that the audience wasn't even considered. I didn't even know what kind of book it was when we were making that book. You know, I didn't see too many examples of, you know, I guess now you could call it a children's book for adults, because it's sort of, it's illustrated, obviously, it's cute, but it's got very dark humor. But it was just an idea that made us laugh. And, you know, it was, at first it was actually a little stapled together mini book, that was,
it has the feel of a zine like that, or like something I would have seen at like SPX, like just a small comic, you know, something that you would have just made yourself and handed out.
Exactly. That's what it was. And it was 12 pages and through a series of events, it ended up in the hands of a Chronicle Books editor who liked it and asked if could we expand it from a 12 page mini book into a 96 page book.
96. Yeah.
Yeah. And
could you quadruple the size of this, please?
And it really, you know, it exceeded everyone's expectations. I think there was a first printing of 10,000.
Holy cow. Wow.
It's pretty
crazy. That's awesome. That's crazy. That's crazy cool.
Yeah, it's crazy cool. And I think it was just so timed perfectly with, you know, certain developments on the internet. Like Tumblr came around and somebody made an animated GIF of some of the pages, and that kind of took off. And
cool.
there were various things that I felt like it was very internet friendly. And
it also felt to me like it just felt to me like what a lot of the like T-shirts were going toward then too. Any one of those pages I felt like would have just been like some Etsy shirt now.
Yeah. I'd wear each page if I could.
I know, right? That's what I'm saying. I'm a bit of a fan, you know.
But thanks. I'm glad you liked it. And it definitely, you know, that was like I said, that was there was no real clear definition of what that was going to be or who it was going to be for more specifically. And it found its audience, but you know, at the time, I really didn't know if it was going to be high school kids or younger children, or if it was going to be college kids. And it's sort of a mix of a variety of groups. You know, we've heard from all different ages responding to the book for various reasons. And
yeah,
and
I would even feel like it was, I would just feel like it was made for you. I mean, that's the granted, everyone else can enjoy it, but it's made for you, for your age, for the point of in life where you were to think that was funny and to want to share that with other people.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I really feel like that was what jump-started my career in a way too. So that basically gave me enough free time to really focus full time on writing and go from there. And you know, the rest leads us up to this exact moment, Matthew, where we're talking on this podcast.
Well, I'm speaking of getting us to this exact moment, talking on this podcast, I accredited a lot to me talking to Benji. Mm. We were talking about Goodnight Already, and we were talking about Storm Whale. But Goodnight Already that you wrote, and again, I think that was the point. And I didn't say this to you prior to recording. It was something I've still been working on in my mind, but I think that was that point where I was talking to Benji, realizing with him that you were the same person that wrote All My Friends Are Dead, that it was, oh my word, I have like both of these books on my shelf, not even connecting that this is the same guy. And then from there, we started talking on Twitter and what have you. But that book, and to see also, I should say, that Goodnight Already is getting a sequel too, is so great. Because that book is like a I don't know. It reads like a sitcom. It's illustrated like a sitcom too, actually.
Man, yeah, Benji. I will just say this about Benji Davies, who's an illustrator. He's been on your show, listeners. If you haven't heard that episode, you should go back and listen to it, and not just because I'm mentioned. You should check it out for other reasons entirely. Benji is so talented. He's so incredibly versatile. If you look at Goodnight Already, the art in Goodnight Already, which is the picture book I collaborated with him on, and then you look at The Storm Whale, which is a book he wrote and illustrated, you know, it's just, you can tell it's him in both cases, but he does very different things in each book, and they're perfect for that exact, you know, for that book.
Yeah.
Where
yep.
Goodnight Already, it has a focus on the bear and his next door neighbor, the duck. And then you look at The Storm Whale and it's sort of this grand ocean scene with, you know, with waves everywhere and a little boat coming in. And it's so precisely exactly what it needs to be that I will just stumble over my words until you cut me off.
No, I mean, I'm going to be the exact same stammering guy for Benji. I'm a big fan of Benji and I think he knows it. I don't shy away from stuff that I like, but it's gorgeous. The work that maybe it's that the talent of a good illustrator to be able to still have their voice in their art, but be so versatile with what stories they're doing. Because if Benji wanted to do, you know, sort of these big cinematic sweeping Storm Whale-esque stories where the environment has just as much to tell you in the story as do the characters and as do these unspoken actions, he could just do that forever. But instead, you know, you flip to Goodnight Already and we strip away all of that and just allow us to focus on your words and the way that these two characters are interacting almost on stage. It's almost like they're on a set.
Yeah, I agree. And he solves some problems in a really nice way. You know, there's a scene where Duck is coming over and asking to borrow a bunch of things, and I wrote it and wondering sort of if it would sort of take a page, a spread, maybe a few pages. There was a bunch of dialogue, and he made it into sort of a circle where you kind of read from the top left and then down and then back around, and it just works so beautifully. And he completely solved exactly how that should have been. I was so happy with. You know, they started sending me some stuff as he was drawing it, and I was like, this guy is absolutely nailing it. I should say Benji and I have never actually met in person. He's in London, and I keep emailing him and saying we got to meet halfway in New York or something. But you know, so far
I hope he comes around. I mean, there's a couple people over there that that I think are immensely talented that I would love to just get to see them here. And I mean, Chris Houghton is the same.
Oh yeah.
That I just feel like these guys are so immensely talented and we're so thankful to be able to have, them illustrating stuff over here as well. Benji's illustrated a ton of work, that hasn't come stateside. So it's great that we are getting some of his stuff. And then to be friends with him on like Twitter or Facebook, he just shares art constantly. It's amazing. And so what's the sequel to Goodnight Already?
The sequel is called I Love You Already, and it features, Bear and Duck again. And, you know, I should say Goodnight Already and the sequel are both written entirely in dialogue. And, one of the fun byproducts is that we are hearing from a lot of librarians and teachers, that it's sort of a go-to, read aloud, which, you know, I'm so glad about, you know, and I'm here, you know, some people will send me recordings of them doing the various voices. Yeah. Like you have to decide how you're going to sound, basically.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, it's like Elephant and Piggy. We all have our own voices for Elephant and Piggy, too.
Exactly. Totally.
So it feels that way.
And George and Martha and so forth. And, yeah, so, you know, there's puppet shows going on of Goodnight Already. And
oh, my word, that's amazing, Jory.
I love it, yeah.
It's your story. You wrote this story to be a book and to be read aloud, but look at the way that... You know, you hand it out to the reading world, and look at the way they give back. Isn't that incredible?
Thanks, Matthew. Yeah, you don't hear about too many read-alouds of All My Friends Are Dead. Although, you know.
We could totally make that happen at ALA upcoming.
I think there are a couple on YouTube if you're really hankering for one. But yeah, nice. working with Benji has been a total treat. I mean, he is a force. I mean, he's illustrating – my stuff. He's illustrating other writer stuff, and then he's writing and illustrating his own stuff. And yeah, and yeah, he's really all over the place in the best way.
Hey, and I should, just to bring things full circle, why don't we bring it back to I Will Chomp You, because the one and only Bob Shea illustrated this, and it feels like, I mean, this is the job of the publisher. I get that this is what they do, but this feels like a Bob Shea story. He ends up illustrating stuff that feels like, yep, this is something that needs Bob Shea's touch on it. And the way that your character is sort of, I don't know. I want to say you've got this like great, overconfident, damaged character in this story, and it works perfectly for the way he illustrated it.
I like that you, in the same conversation, you say, I write about me, and then I also write about an overconfident, damaged character.
So, Jory, are you lying down?
I will be after this.
Tell me about your mother. No.
Oh, man. But you're, all right, you're absolutely right. I will say about Bob Shea, he is one of my all-time picture book heroes, and you know, the fact that Benji and I live in different continents, Bob and I live on different coasts, but we have had a chance to meet a couple of times, and it's just been like hanging out with an old friend. He's such a down-to-earth, funny, personable guy, and he was everything that I was hoping. In person, I was nervous to meet him. You know, after you write a book and he's already illustrated it, you want the first meeting to go well, and it went really well. And anyway, so yeah, I see what you mean though in terms of like the pacing and the humor. I feel like it's in that sort of same canon, and I'll take that absolutely as a high compliment. I mean, I was so happy that he signed on to illustrate it, and I think you'll see, you have a copy, but no one listening has a copy yet, but
well, let's be fair, four other people have a copy. maybe they are listening as well.
Although three of them are me and my two cats.
Oh, well, you're right.
But there are some incredibly beautiful spreads in I Will Chomp You. It's certainly a humor book. It's written as a monologue, but there are some of the you just have to see some of these spreads that Bob pulled off. They're really gorgeous. And
I agree. Yeah.
Yeah.
I like that. I mean, in this, do you mind if I sum the story? Because I've read it actually to a lot of kids, and then I've read it to my son a lot. It's already become one of his favorite books, and he, being four, I don't think understands the notion of this sort of floppy copy, of a folded and gathered copy. It's not bound yet, and right, so he has a hard time with how we have to juggle the pages. But it's like his favorite book.
That's so great. Will you ask him to blurb it for me?
Oh, I totally should. I could get that on recording. That'd be amazing. Jory, I will. I will do my best. Just know that 30 seconds in, he might start talking about trains or diggers or something. It's just going to happen. Well, so I like that in this story, like you said, it's a monologue. The main character from even before the title page is saying, don't read this book, I'm going to chomp you. And then he does keep attempting to chomp the reader with this great, you know, full page spread of these teeth chomping down on the reader. And you learn halfway through that it's just the secret that the character trusts you with is that he doesn't want you to – he has all these cakes that he's been hiding, all these desserts that he's been saving. And he doesn't want to have to share them, but he'll share them with you since you discovered them.
Right.
And that spread, when you get there to that spread of all the desserts and cakes, it's beautiful. I mean,
yeah,
suddenly the colors just, it feels like you are walking into sort of a treasure room where, you know, the way that we grew up seeing all these cartoons and whatever of treasure rooms where the gold just shines off your face. It you know, Bob illustrated it that way, where it's just this beautiful, sort of, I don't know, brightly tinted page. Of all these delicious desserts, but yet the character unflinchingly still wants to guard his precious stash of desserts.
Yeah, and I feel like there's something in there about, you know, hoarding versus sharing so forth. But it's not really necessarily designed to teach a lesson as much as it is just to make kids laugh. But I think that's an excellent description, and I really want to have this spread that Bob drew printed up to be a ceiling size print that I could just lie on the floor and stare up to and just look at all the Bob Shea cakes and so forth.
I love And if I were you, I would love forever as my Twitter avatar that he illustrated you both as cakes in the end on the jacket.
It's so true. And he had such a good point. You know, he just sent me a quick email and said, you know, we could use photos or we could be illustrated cakes. And I thought that was the best idea. And I'm not opposed to using author photos for various things, but I will say that that drawing of the cake that he did of me looks a lot better than I actually do in person. So that it made me very happy. Yeah.
Yeah. I love your text in this story. I love, like you're saying, that it just makes it so perfect and fun to read aloud. I want to just read one spread if you don't mind.
Oh yeah.
And this is after one or two initial chomping attempts. He says, "Well, I missed, but I won't miss again. You do not want to turn another page, Buster. You do not want these feet running at you. You do not want these teeth chomping at you. That's it. Here I come." And then there's this huge chomp, like right through the page on the following turn. And when I read it to a group, or when I have read it to a group, and this is me, of course, juggling all the pages, to have those chomp pages that you can just, you know, put right in the faces of the readers chomping at you, to have the book come alive in that way, the character jumping out of the page that way, Jory, that I think is a testament to your talent as a writer as well, to make those words want to jump out and just pull the reader in. It's wonderful. Well, you've done an excellent job.
Thank you, Matthew. And I really liked your reading a lot. In fact, that was the first time I've heard it read. So I'm glad I was here for this, and I will play this back often to myself.
Hey, okay, you're being overly kind, which I totally adore. You can lay it on.
So are you.
You can thicker if you want. But what is that like as an author to first hear someone read your book? I bring it up on here a lot because of the way you come from drama in that way, so you'll understand the way that I always talk about picture books. Reading picture books is drama, and that's to say that not everyone – I think knows how to read aloud a picture book well. But at the same time, as you do with different manuscripts, as you do with different works like that, everyone does read and perform the characters differently, putting their own spin on it. So what is it like for you as the playwright in that way to experience hearing someone else read your story? Are there ever times when maybe perhaps you're even surprised and it allows you to enjoy your story in a different light?
Absolutely. I mean, going all the way back to, the humor books, All My Friends Are Dead, I definitely, I would be surprised when somebody would post something online of them reading the book. And you would get different things. You would get what part they liked the most, what part made them laugh. I've definitely, when Mac and I were visiting Schools for the Terrible 2, there was a moment I remember very specifically when we were about to leave the school and we were standing in a school library and a librarian pulled a group of kids over and started reading them The Terrible 2, which is, this book that we had lived with for so long. We had the idea and then we had a year worth of writing maybe 10 months worth of writing. And then it took another year for the book to come out. And then all of a sudden it was a live thing being read in a library to some real kids in Texas. And we just happened to be hovering at the back and watching them. And it was really a very special moment for me. I'll definitely always remember that. And, this instance where you read I Will Chomp You for the first time and it's coming out in a month and no one's seen it. And, it just gets me excited again. And, this book that, it's like coming back to a person you, sort of were in a way when you meet this picture book again. For instance, I wrote the book in, early 2013, I think. And now it's July 2015. It's more than 2 years later. And that's sort of how long the process takes in terms of, just the whole thing. And it's suddenly about to be out in the world. And like I said, you have one of the few copies. And so it's at your house. It's being read to your son, which makes me really happy. And the fact that it's going over well makes me even happier. So it's a really, It's kind of surreal in a way when you realize that other people are actually reading your words and that right this moment somewhere somebody's probably reading from The Terrible 2 or somebody's reading Goodnight Already out loud, and And yeah, just in those few instances where I've experienced it, where I've hubbed.
Let me just say that I love having the opportunity to read to you. Thank you for giving me a chance to read to you. But also to share that idea of what it means to be the author, getting to hear your story read aloud. Like in the case of I Will Chomp You, that it's been 2 years now, and you will soon get to start hearing people reading it aloud in libraries across the country and in bookstores and things like that. That's really great to know that that's something that means something to you as well, because you're the one that created this. But I think a lot of us, any reader that loves a book, ends up feeling sort of proprietary about that book because you love it. It becomes your thing too.
Well, I'm just really, I'm really excited to see it sort of come out into the world because, you know, there's only so long you can live with an idea. And I think 2 years is the maximum. and really you do see sort of, it's interesting hearing people read your stuff because they pick up on different things. They accentuate certain points differently than you might. Mm. They adopt a voice for a character that might be helpful. Like, I've heard some folks read Goodnight already out loud and, you know, take on certain mannerisms for the bear and certain mannerisms for the duck. And I think that's pretty good. And then, you know, so you even in my own readings, I'll sort of evolve and that's all sort of organic. It just sort of feeds into the mix of, you know, hearing them read your stuff and then you read it back to them. And so it's a fun process.
That's awesome. I in no small way am already looking forward to talking to you again because of just, I don't know. Jory, it's been amazing talking to you. I want you to know that for me, it's been amazing.
Oh, thanks,
and,
Matthew.
I feel like this is a chat that I don't want to end, but I feel that it's time to wrap things up because I know we're going to have a ton to talk about next time our paths cross, which hopefully will be sooner than later. But before I let you go, I want to ask you one more question just to, you know, sort of learn another thing about you that I hadn't asked previously.
Sure.
So that is, I'm assembling an all-star Kidlit Dream Team kickball tournament. And Jory, I'd love to know what one person alive or past from the Kidlit world you'd want on your team and why.
Well, that is a good question. And if this was any other sport, say this was Ultimate Frisbee, it would be James Thurber and E.B. White for obvious reasons. But it's not Ultimate Frisbee. I think for my kickball team and I would love to be a part of that kickball team with you someday in real life, Matthew.
I hope it happens. It might. This might be the year.
Well, it sounds like you're really going for it, you know? And so I'll just say that my dream pick, and I don't know if somebody's already claimed this person. You can tell me if that's the case. And I brought him up earlier, is James Marshall. And James Marshall is one of my all-time heroes in children's writing. He is so funny, and my particular favorites are George and Martha, the two lovable hapless hippo friends who have generally five short adventures in every book and hilarious conversations. James Marshall I would choose because I think the conversations with him would be hilarious. I also think Marshall had a lot of heart in his writing, and I'm sure that we would get pretty deep together. And I also feel like in I don't know how many books he did, maybe around 75 or so, he was given a runner-up. He was given the Caldecott Honor in 1989, and that was sort of, at least as far as I know, the only medal he was given while he was alive. And I feel like I would give him a really big trophy that had both a children's book and a kickball on it, and it would say first place, James Marshall. So that's who I would choose. And now you can tell me, has anybody already claimed him?
Yeah, I was just thinking that. I think I have to go back and listen. I think one person has said James Marshall, and I actually think it might have been Bob Shea. And that's making me smile in such a great way to think that your brains kind of go that same way. And the sentimentality that you have for James is something that I think a lot of people have. I think that that's something that, I mean, there was, as you said it, there was so much heart in there. If I were to take the question as literally as you could, with just what best mate would I want on the field with me in that way, choosing someone with a lot of heart goes a long, long way.
Yeah, and
a lot
also
of good stories and good heart.
James Marshall had incredible calf muscles, and I feel like he would really be a good designated kicker. And
so maybe on the trophy, you need a number one and a kickball and a calf muscle outline.
Yeah, and I will admit that I don't actually know if he had amazing calf muscles, but I assume he did. And because of that, I will say, though, I also wanted to just respond to your compliment of earlier sentences. And and I just wanted to thank you. It's been a total pleasure. I listen to your show all the time. Clearly, I need to listen to the Bob Shea episode to determine whether or not he picked James Marshall. But I really wanted to thank you for inviting me on. And I think you do such a great job as an interviewer and an appreciator of children's literature. And you're doing a great service, you know, bringing people sort of out of their shells and getting them to talk about their art. And so, yeah, I really wanted to thank you for what you do.
Like what you hear? I'd love to hear your thoughts. Leave a comment on the blog at lgbpodcast.blogspot.com or rate Let's Get Busy on iTunes or Stitcher through stars or reviews. Sharing the podcast with friends through Facebook, Twitter, word of mouth, or any other means helps reach more listeners, which leads to more content and more amazing guests. And that's a very good thing indeed. We know you value what you put in front of your kids, especially when it comes to screens and podcasts. That's why we're excited to share a new podcast from our friends at Sleepiest, creating bedtime stories to help your kids fall asleep fast.
Hello, Abby here. If you've got children and find bedtime's a struggle, I'd like to tell you about Coco Sleep, a children's story podcast designed to make bedtime a dream. Coco Sleep turns a chaotic bedtime into cozy bonding time. The stories are delivered in a pace that gently slows. Rumour has it that no one's ever heard an ending. So search Coco Sleep on your favourite podcast app and let's make bedtime a dream. That's K-O-K-O Sleep, and I'll see you there.